I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Steve Michael. He's Chief Counsel for the Energy Program at Western Resource Advocates, and Marielle Nanasi, who is Executive Director of New Energy Economy. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having us.
I'm Mary Charlotte.
So we are here to talk about the clean energy standard, or the possibility of a clean energy standard here in New Mexico, here in the United States of America. First of all, what is that? What does this concept mean?
A clean energy standard is a mechanism to reduce carbon dioxide emissions from electric utilities and electric power plants. It's a regulatory scheme that would have utilities reduce their CO2 footprint by a certain percentage each year over time. And there are various design characteristics, but in a nutshell, that's what it does and that's what it is.
And so what are the mechanisms by which it works?
Well, the way we've designed it is each utility would have a baseline or a base period during which you would measure the carbon dioxide emissions associated with its production and sale of energy or electricity. From that baseline, then, utilities would reduce that footprint 3% per year. It would work through a credit system where the cleaner the utility operates, the more credits it gets. And regulators, by requiring the retirement of more and more credits each year, drive reductions. The nice thing about it is credits are tradable, so that it's a market-based solution that would allow some utilities to overachieve, others to underachieve, and trade credits in a way that overall we get the carbon reductions we need, but we do it in a very economic market-based way.
So we have just seen, for example, this film, A Fierce Green Fire, which was a wonderful film about the history of the environmental movement. And one of the things in it was, for example, the environmental movement back in the 70s was trying to get polluting factories to reduce their pollution. And they basically sort of made a deal, and because those companies said, Our factories are old, and when we take them offline, we'll build clean new ones, so don't penalize us for the old ones. And the movement said, well, okay. And then they never did. They never built new factories. So, I mean, is there a level of trust involved in this? Is there a penalty mechanism that is effective?
Well, I wouldn't say there's a trust element to this. The regulation, to the extent it's enforced, and it should be enforced, would require reductions. So if a utility had an old power plant, say an old coal plant, that they were expecting to retire and didn't retire, they would have to find credit some other way, either through additional renewables or trading credits with the utility that retired a coal plant earlier than it thought it would. So overall, you're still getting the reductions you want, and as long as the regulation's enforced, it really isn't an issue of trust, it's an issue of enforcement.
So how are we building, I mean, is there a political movement building to make something like this happen?
Well, what's exciting about it is that this in essence, puts a price on carbon. This is what we need for our economy to survive. When we filed it with the New Mexico Public Regulation Commission, there were 33 statewide organizations that joined with Western Resource Advocates and New Energy Economy. And so that showed the breadth and depth of support in New Mexico for this. And it was everything from the League of Women Voters to the American Lung Association who joined us. And there were groups in Taos, and there were groups in Los Alamos, and in Wagon Mound. I mean, everywhere in New Mexico, because people realize that we have to deal with the carbon pollution that's causing both global warming, and our particular version here is droughts and wildfires, and also the local health impacts as a result of fossil fuel dependence. And unfortunately, PNM has 80% of its, more than 80% of its of its energy mix comes from fossil fuels, and very little, 1%, comes from solar. And just a fraction more of that from wind. And we really need to transition, and we need to transition now if we're going to really have a habitable planet. How many more Hurricane Sandys can our economy, let alone our people, be able to survive? I mean, that, I don't know what the numbers are, but I think it's something like $100 billion that Hurricane Sandy cost in New York and the East Coast. And here we're seeing, I mean, we just had back-to-back mega wildfires that they'd never seen ever before. And those cost us, I think, $200 million a piece. So, or at least that, if not more than that. So we're talking about an economic solution that has durability and that's doable for us. It's a transition. It incentivizes solar and wind, and it incentivizes energy efficiency, and that's where we need to go.
So this is a clean energy standard. Do we see other countries that have clean energy standards already in place?
This mechanism hasn't been used in other countries, and that raises an important point, Mary Charlotte, that I'd like to make, which is that, you know, once you've accepted the science of climate change, there are a lot of ways to address that. We've heard about cap and trade, we've heard about carbon taxes, we've heard about clean energy standards. All those regulatory schemes will work, or can work. The thing that we like about a clean energy standard is it's very low cost, it's market neutral, it's technology, or it's market based, it's technology neutral. And that's why we think it's a very good mechanism, at least for the electricity sector, which is a major contributor to climate change and greenhouse gases. We think it's a very good mechanism to deploy in that sector, and that's why we're pursuing it.
What's exciting is that, you know, New Mexico is an energy producing and exporting state, and if we have a clean energy standard that's implemented, that's on the ground, that's working, that is not devastating PNM, but is actually causing real reductions in carbon pollution, then when the next Sandy-esque event occurs, maybe there will be enough public clamor for some action on climate. And that's what we're really hoping, that this will be a model that will be implemented and that's working, and that the Obama administration will look to and say, hey, if they can do it in New Mexico, we can do it, and we can lift this onto a national scale and really and replicate it.
We do have a Republican governor who has been pretty hostile toward initiatives like this so far. How do you expect to do this?
Well, we think that the New Mexico Environment Department under Governor Martinez is open to looking at this. And that's a very encouraging sign. I think that for a number of reasons, that this governor might be open to what's happening. I mean, she had one position before when she ran, and you know, things are changing, including those two mega wildfires. Like nothing
yeah.
like reality that can wake somebody up.
Yeah,
and
I mean, I think the number of climate deniers is going precipitously down these days.
I think so, and this doesn't cost PNM anything, and so. It just basically encourages them to transition as quickly as possible off of fossil fuel dependence. And what's specifically interesting about the clean energy standard is that the Obama administration, when he has talked about any specific policy, has mentioned the clean energy standard. So we're hoping that there will be some uptake there.
It's interesting. You talked about doing things that basically wouldn't hurt the utilities, because if you do that, you'll never get them on board and so on. I was reading an article that's been going around the environmental community the other day about how the Edison Electric Institute, which is a very politically neutral, if not right-wing group, basically did an assessment of the potential effect of rooftop solar, which is not just limited to sunny places like this, but it's happening all over the United States, could really destroy the utilities of this country.
Right, and that's one of the bones of contention that New Energy Economy has had with PNM, is that they have not put enough utility scale solar up, and you know, that we're too dependent on, you know, in a place where we have vast potential. But I like to say, I don't look at my children in their eyes and I say, oh, you have so much potential. I want them to actualize it, and I want this utility to actualize it and to really respond to the needs and the desires of New Mexicans. I mean, the polling shows that 75% across party, across age, across ethnicity want to have more solar and wind in a place that is sunny and has wind resources, vast resources. And we need to, there's no question that we need to have a much more diverse energy mix that includes renewables.
We're talking to Mariel Nanasi and Steve Michael. So how do our New Mexican politicians in general feel about this? How have they come forward on this issue of a clean energy standard?
Well, we've talked with some. The clean energy standard we've developed would be promulgated by the New Mexico Public Regulation Commission. We've talked with them. We've had some work. We've had a workshop with them. We think they're open to it. One of the things that's worth mentioning is, you know, as Mariel said, you know, one of the things we're trying to do is demonstrate that this is a workable mechanism that really makes a lot of sense. And we have a unique opportunity here in New Mexico to do that. We have utility PNM that's indicated its plans to shut down some of its coal-fired generation, which is great. Because they're doing that, we can demonstrate the workability of a clean energy standard in a way that is not going to cost PNM any additional money or its customers. They're reducing anyway. They may as well take advantage of it. And that's something we've been talking with PNM about, and we're hopeful that they see it that way as well. But we do have an opportunity here to do this in a way that's basically cost-free and actually positions utilities pretty well to deal with future climate regulation, which hopefully we'll see before too long.
So if this were implemented on some kind of pretty soon time frame, what would it actually mean for carbon emissions?
It means that within the next 20 years, we would reduce our carbon emissions by 60%, which is extremely significant. That might actually give us enough of an opportunity, a window that we desperately need to. This isn't a panacea. This is just an opportunity, but a strong opportunity, a real opportunity, one that could possibly give us a way to deal with mitigating basically the worst impacts of climate disruption.
Now, a lot of people who have been examining this from an environmental and economic and political standpoint will tell you that the most important thing to do worldwide, nationwide, is a carbon tax. How would this be compatible with or relate to that kind of policy?
So, Mary Charlotte, I think what folks are actually saying is we need to have a price on carbon, and a carbon tax is one way to do that. Clean Energy Standard also puts a price on carbon. The concerns with a carbon tax, or the challenges with a carbon tax, are twofold. One is it requires polluters to pay for every ton they emit, whereas a Clean Energy Standard requires polluters only to pay for the tons they reduce. And what that means is a clean energy standard, from a compliance standpoint, is a less costly way forward, at least in the early years, than a carbon tax. What a clean energy standard doesn't do, though, is it doesn't generate revenues for government, which is what a carbon tax could do. And there are certainly some reasons why there needs to be some fiscal, some fiscal relief at government levels. The other thing with a carbon tax is, what you're doing with a carbon tax is you're setting a price, and you're hoping the price is high enough to drive the emission reductions that you want. What a clean energy standard does, though, instead, is it says, we're going to get these reductions, which are the reductions we need, and it lets the price fluctuate to determine how much it's going to cost to get there. Given that we know how much carbon we need to reduce, in my mind, it makes more sense to say, these are the reductions we need, and the price will fall out where it does, and hopefully it won't be too onerous or too difficult or too challenging for folks to meet.
Now, if people want to get involved with this issue or learn more about it or make their voice heard, is there a way for them to do so?
Yeah, we would love for you to go to our website. It's newenergyeconomy.org, and there's a page on there specifically dedicated to the clean energy standard. You can write a letter and send it directly from the website to the Public Regulation Commission endorsing action on climate, action putting a price on carbon that we've been talking about. And then please just call either of our offices, Western Resource Advocates in Santa Fe or New Energy Economy. You can visit our website or call our offices. We would love for lots of people to get involved. We need everybody, nurses and artists and politicians. We need regular people. This is our problem, and we need to address it. And it's actually exciting to work on something that's hopeful and positive, and take some real meaningful, you know, action.
Marielle Nanasi is Executive Director of New Energy Economy, which is on the web at newenergyeconomy.org. Steve Michael is Chief Counsel for the Energy Program at Western Resource Advocates, which is on the web at westernresourceadvocates.org. Thank you both so much for being with us today on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I'm very happy now to welcome Bob Zimmerman. He's president of the Santa Fe Master Gardeners, and Janine Cabasel, who will be speaking at the annual Spring Garden Fair, which is happening this weekend on Saturday from 10 to 4 at the Santa Fe County Fairgrounds. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Good to be here.
Thank you.
Now, let's talk about what's happening. This is something you do every year. It's the 9th annual, and it is a really major event. You've got all kinds of people talking, including Janine, who is known as the Tomato Lady. What's it all about? What's happening?
Well, this is our signature event for the year, our outreach to the community. It's quite a big event. We have lectures, clinics, kids activities. We have a junior gardeners activity area where kids can learn about gardening. We have vendors and exhibitors. We have a tool sharpening, so if you have any dull tools, you can come and get them sharpened up. But the big highlight is our lecture series. We have Les Crowder coming in. He's the president of the New Mexico Beekeepers, talking about honeybees and bee-friendly gardening practices.
Now, that's huge because there's almost no honeybees left.
Well, the commercial honeybees are being threatened, right. And I think he'll talk about that and how important it is to have good practices in your own yard so you're not hurting the honeybees that they are left.
It's funny. Sometimes when I'm not a very good gardener, and, mm-hmm. but I try to plant things every year.
That's
and sometimes
right.
fail, and some few things keep growing. But
yeah.
especially the ones that are so tolerant that no matter what I do, they still survive. But when you go to a nursery, like you go to Aguafria Nursery, mm-hmm. what I do is I choose the flowers that have bees on them.
That's right.
I figure if there's bees there, there'll be bees in my yard.
Exactly. And that's what Les will be talking about. And also, what to do and what not to do in terms of the health of the honeybees in your yard. Another speaker we're having is Ann Schmaus from Wild Birds Unlimited. And she'll be speaking about attracting birds year-round to your garden in terms of what flowers to plant, what trees to plant, why it's important to have good landscape features for that. So that'll be pretty exciting. And, of course, then we have Janine talking about getting the most out of your garden with vegetables. And
now let's talk for a moment about tomatoes. You are known for growing fabulous tomatoes and very big vegetables. Is that true?
Yes, I grow heirloom tomatoes organically, and that's kind of my specialty, if you will. When I became a master gardener, I loved the vegetable garden, and so that's where my emphasis has been. But then I kind of zeroed in on tomatoes. And then, just for fun, I started one year growing a giant pumpkin, and did not win a state record that year, but the next year I did, and for 2 or 3 years after that I had the record. I also hold the record for a 340-pound giant green squash.
Good
and a
heavens.
64-pound zucchini.
Good heavens. How big was your giant pumpkin?
It was 448 pounds.
What?
Which is, you know, small in the giant pumpkin world when the...
The world, giant pumpkin world.
Yeah,
ladies and gentlemen, there is a giant pumpkin world.
The record, the world record is over 2,000 pounds, a ton. But out here, you know, it's very hard to grow anything, as you know, with our short season and our alkaline soil. And we're so high up in altitude, the UV burns a lot of plants. And so, you know, with that short season, it's I feel it's a pretty good accomplishment to be able to to at least hold the state record.
How do you do it? I mean, what do you do to make a pumpkin or a squash or whatever giant?
Well, when I first got into the sport, if you will, I talked to other giant pumpkin growers, and they all told me it's all about the soil, baby, and make your soil fertile. And that's when I teach classes. I teach a lot of classes around here for master gardeners, for the public, for Homegrown New Mexico, which is, you know, for food. And then also for in the community gardens. And I always try to stress, you know, we've got to keep improving our soil every year.
But there's got to be more than that if you want a 400-pound pumpkin.
And I grow them organically, so I don't use chemical fertilizers. I use seaweed and fish emulsion as my two main fertilizers, which are organic. And I use mycorrhizal, which is a fungus that creates really good huge roots on the plants, which is very helpful to collect the water, or what water we get. And I use earthworm castings called vermicompost, and I use regular compost. So I'm constantly improving the soil that way. I get the soil tested. If it says it's short in calcium or some other amendment I need, then I'll add that usually in the fall so it can sit all winter and be ready for the spring.
So you just basically make fabulously fertile soil and presto, giant pumpkins arise.
Well, you know, you got to get the right seed, the right variety. And
Okay. So there's some that grow really big anyway.
Yes, Atlantic Giant grows the biggest pumpkins in the world. That's the variety. You know, you could grow a Tom Thumb, and that'll grow a tiny little variety that you would put on your kitchen table in the fall. But the Atlantic Giants they can go anywhere from 200 pounds on up.
Very interesting. So something which is probably more to most people's daily needs or wants is growing really tasty tomatoes. What are some of the secrets for doing that here in New Mexico?
Well, it's interesting you ask that, because I always tell people that the giant growers of vegetables are actually the most advanced growers that I know of. They have the most advanced techniques. I learn more from them way earlier than I learned from anybody else, and that was some of the things we just talked about. And then you know, every time I plant, I always transplant a tomato here. We don't have enough time to grow them from seed. You know, our last freeze date is May 15th. There are ways to sneak them in a little earlier, so maybe you get tomatoes a little earlier, but normally I say, for most people, if you're not a gambler, be safe, plant your tomato plants. So go buy them at Agrofria, Payne's, Newman, Southwest, wherever you buy your starts, and then put them in the ground. And then I really even more heavily amend.
So what, June 1st?
No, try May 15th.
May 15th,
if you can.
Okay.
And I use a thing called Walla Waters, which is kind of like a little cloche or greenhouse around each plant, and it gives it some protection should we get one of those heavy freezes like we just had last week.
Yeah. Or like, was it last year or the year before? Mm-hmm. It snowed on May 30th?
Mm-hmm. I know. Yeah, and then last year you could have put everything in from April 15th on, but I kept holding off because from my pumpkins specifically, because I kept thinking, oh no, they're very sensitive to frost and freezes. I said, if we get one freeze, it'll wipe me out for the season. So I held on and held on and held on. I did put them in about June 1, and I should have put them in April 15th. I would have had a month and a half.
Well, yeah, and I suppose people could put some in April 15th and some other ones in May 1st and
yeah.
So on. And just
yeah. I'm doing that this year. I'm having some backups.
Yeah.
I'm going to try to get them in earlier. And if the first ones fail, then I got the backups to put in when it is warmer.
So then over the course of the growing season, before you actually have your beautiful ripe tomatoes, what are some of the things you do to keep them growing?
You have to keep them kind of pruned. And so you have to pinch off the suckers on them just so they don't get totally crazy. It's nice if you have a decent sized cage. A lot of these heirlooms get big. Mine get anywhere from 5 to 7 feet tall, and you got to give them sufficient water, and you got to do it regularly, and preferably from a drip system, so you're not splashing dirt back on. If you water from the top, you splash dirt back up on the lower branches, and that's usually where the tomato fungal diseases start, is from that splash. And it also happens from rain, when rain splashes on the bottom and it jumps up. And if you ever notice, most tomato diseases, they start turning yellow on the bottom and people start trimming them frantically, and it works its way up through the plant. So if you could water with a drip system and make sure you have big, deep wells, when the weather gets hot, put a straw mulch or some kind of mulch over it to help hold that water in. And the mulch also helps keep that soil from jumping up on the plants.
So we are talking about the Santa Fe Master Gardener Association Spring Fair, which is happening this coming Saturday, and you'll be talking about this and a lot more.
Yes.
At the fair. Now, and we'll be hearing about the birds and the bees.
That's right.
And the tomatoes.
Right.
And there's also a big plant sale, so people can kind of buy whatever they want, including, I love it on your thing, you say rabbit-resistant plants.
That's
is that
right.
A problem for a lot of people?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. And I have a resident rabbit in the yard and just have to make, put little cages around the little baby plants if you have it. Have them, otherwise they won't be there the next day. So
once they get bigger, is that...
Well, right. I mean, if you have like a shrub or anything, and once it gets bigger, the rabbit won't, get quite as... maybe eat the lower branches, but...
It's not like you can just put out other things for them to eat so they'll leave your plants alone.
Well,
that would probably attract every rabbit in Santa Fe.
That's probably right. I know some people who keep a little grass patch. We don't really grow a lot of green grass, but they do have a little grass patch, and that's where the rabbits will go first and maybe get full before they go into your garden.
I have a little grass patch for my dogs
that
arises naturally, but dogs, people think... They only eat grass when they're sick, but they need to eat grass all year round.
Right.
And so it's good to have your little grass patch.
Well, the interesting thing about the garden fair on Saturday is that if you come, and we encourage everybody to come, you'll learn not only about the tomatoes and the bees, but you'll also learn how to make this compost and how to make compost tea, which is a good way of fertilizing it. Almost all the local plant societies will be there, the Rose Society, the Iris Society, the Native Plant Society, the Herbs. So if you have any interest, this is where you could go and get some really specific information about gardening. And it's free, too, which is a wonderful thing. And hopefully we'll have good weather. I think the forecast is looking good. We're keeping our fingers crossed.
It sounds like a parade, the Rose Society, Iris Society,
right.
Each with its own float.
It is. It's like that. They have a table, and they're so excited, to talk about their passion and share it with others. And that's
there's
really
lots
fun.
Of handouts. And, in the demos, we're showing how to make a rain barrel from just a regular plastic rain barrel, how to put the faucet part of it on and the top part to collect the water, off of your canali. And so there's a lot of clinics and demos that are really, really worth it besides just listening to the lecturers. And then exhibitors, I always love to go around and collect anything. And, there'll be the bee people there as well. And you can pick up stuff of bee-friendly plants, from them. And also what insecticides not to use to protect the bees nowadays. And, I think more and more people, in regards to bees, because I am a beekeeper and so is Bob, is that, there's not that much food out there for them around here with these droughts that we're having. So we like to encourage... Instead of becoming a beekeeper, more people to grow bee-friendly plants to provide the nectar and pollen for them that they need.
So it's a big event. It's happening this Saturday. Once again, it's from...
10 to 4.
Okay. Once again, it's from 10 to 4 at the Santa Fe County Fairgrounds, which is right on Rodeo Road. For more information, you can go to the Santa Fe Master Gardener Association website, which is sfmga.org. And we want to thank you both so much for being here, Bob Zimmerman, president of the Santa Fe Master Gardeners, and Janine Cavasel, who is the tomato lady. Thanks for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm very happy now to welcome back to the program Galen Duke and Xenia Victor. They are the directors and founders of the Bali Art Project. And Selena Baca joins us. She's one of the former students at the Bali Art Project. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, good morning.
Thank you.
It's wonderful to have you here again. Now, every year we talk about this wonderful thing that the two of you do and for which you have earned a Living Treasures Award. The concept is to get young people, juniors in high school from Santa Fe to another country and teach them how to be world travelers.
Right. And be aware of that there is a world and there are many ways to live life and there are many opportunities and possibilities and choices.
And that not everybody necessarily wants our way.
That's right.
And so how did you start that?
My father died and left us a little more money than we thought we needed. So we decided we would start this project. We learn mostly by travel. Both of us have our degrees and all that stuff, but really what we have learned is through travel. And we were sad to see that young Americans were no longer out there with their backpacks. They were out there maybe going to kayak or mountain climb, but not to just see what the world, other cultures are about.
And so, whereas in the 70s and 80s, there were people out there, Americans out there all over the place.
There were mostly Americans. There were some Brits, a lot of British, always the Germans. But the Americans were the most, you know, and they were adventurous. They were way out there.
What do you think happened?
I think the country got wimpish.
I think we had a political culture in this country based on fear, a fear of the over there places, and, you know, that everything here is best, so why would you want to go any other place?
I always wonder also whether it's just the fact that there's been so much upward flow of capital, the 1% sort of has everything, and there's not a lot of disposable income to go traveling.
If people want, even kids, if they want to travel, they can do it. Like, I'm sure Selena can say that. The other kids we've had taken to Bali, if they want to go back and travel or do something else, they can work their senior year. We've had kids that work 3 jobs their senior year so they can travel.
Right.
So it's possible to, you know, if you're determined to do it, you can do it.
So, Selena, when you went to Bali last year, was that the first time you'd ever left the country?
Yes.
So what was it like for you?
It was incredible. It was totally different and exciting. There's so much to learn. My senses are on overload.
Did you have any favorite moments or places?
Oh, man, it was all my favorite.
What are some of the things that you actually did during your stay there?
We learned how to paint. We learned about puppet making. We learned how to play the gamelan, which is a series of instruments. We performed, which is a huge fear of mine, but it was fun. It was awesome. We learned about the culture. We embraced it.
And you are actually going back again.
Yeah, I worked 2 jobs my senior year to go back again.
Amazing. Yeah. And of course you make friends, probably friends for life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been awesome.
So part of the way that the Bali Art Project works is that the young people and you guys fundraise so that nobody is having to pay huge amounts of money out of their own pockets.
Right. We all fundraise as a group, and the money goes to everybody. The kids write a letter, they create a logo and a text, and we mail that out. And then next Sunday, April 28th, from 11 to 5, will be our big fundraiser, which is an art show of the kids' works and artwork and other things donated by friends of the project.
And there's some Balinese stuff every year, isn't there?
Always some Balinese stuff, yeah.
What kind of artworks are we talking about?
Well, the kids have done some wonderful prints, monoprints, we have so many friends that have given watercolors and paintings, and we have jewelry from Bali, we have wooden carvings, we have baskets, just a variety of things. Mrs. Galen and I did importing for many years, so we have a lot of,
right.
And fabrics, we have wonderful fabrics. So all of that goes into the sale, and all of the money from the sale goes to the project.
So you go every year, you've been going for a long time, and Bali has changed quite a bit since you started going. You go to Ubud, which is one of the major cities there.
Yeah, we've been going, this is our 14th year.
Wow.
14th year, it's amazing.
How's it changed?
Too many tourists, yeah. However, we kind of wiggle our way around that because we go to people's homes. The classes are in people's homes, or the music and dance classes are in the community theater, and we're the only non-Balinese to study there. So we kind of, it's like being in Santa Fe in tourist time. We live there, and it's a different way.
Right, right.
And I also wanted to clarify something that Selena said. She's coming back to Bali at the same time we are, but she's not coming as part of the project.
Right.
She and her stepmom are coming back, and glad to see her. And last year when she was there were 2 kids from 2 years before that had come back at the same time and having their own trip but staying where we were.
They really inspired me to actually earn the money and save it and be able to go, because it was such an abstract idea to, I mean, make it a priority to go back or to save money to travel. But seeing these two young kids do it on their own was really great to see.
Yeah, and it's such a perfect example of how when somebody else does it, you feel like you can do it too. What are you going to do when you're there?
I'm kind of going to do not exactly the same thing. We're going to we don't actually know yet. But, I mean, we're going to have some beach time. We're going to have some time in the city. We're going to see if we can volunteer while we're there. Let's see what happens. Meet our old friends again.
What do you hear from the alumni who've been on the trip in past years? I mean, if the first one was 14 years ago, these people are now in their late 20s or older, no? Mm-hmm.
31, I think, yeah. Is the oldest, 32. We're in touch with all but two or three of them. And, you know, some kids we think we've lost contact with, and they show up, or here comes an email, or they appear on Facebook saying, not a day goes by that I don't think of Bali and stuff like that. One of the more interesting boys is Jonathan Harold Naranjo, who teaches Indonesian to the kids and also works at the Santa Fe Community College. John learned enough Indonesian his first year that we took him back the third year as an assistant. And now for the last 13 years now, he's been teaching Indonesian to the kids before we go.
Amazing. Yeah.
And he teaches Heritage Spanish at the community college.
That's right.
And he's just brilliant.
Yeah, we've had him on the air actually talking about Heritage Spanish.
Yeah. We have one girl in Ghana who's working on sustainable technology. We have a boy in West Africa working on turning trash into compost. They're teaching all over the place. They're a lot doing artwork. One boy has become a professional drummer. They're just doing wonderful, interesting things. One boy has done documentaries, mostly socially involved topics. I mean, it's really inspiring.
And so this is really about, just in your small way, training the next generation to have a global perspective.
Right, right. And it's, I mean, we're still doing it after 14 years because we watch the kids over a year change so, and then they're out there with great courage and independence.
And they always keep traveling. That's one of the things that's so beautiful about it.
Right, right.
And you teach them budget traveling, and you teach them how to bargain and negotiate at markets,
right,
and those
right.
kinds of things.
Yeah. They also do a three-day homestay, and that's really pushing it. Right, right, Selena? That was the hardest part?
No, it was the best part, probably, now that I think about it.
But yeah. Ahead of time, the hardest part.
Yeah, that was really scary.
Yeah, I mean, there are things like the bathroom is very different in these modest homes, right? So we have a whole thing about the bathroom.
Right.
And how to eat with them. You know, just different. I'm like, the Balinese don't sit down to dinner together. It's just not what they do. So we have, the kids are going to wind up eating sometimes facing a wall because it's not polite. You know?
Right.
So. But and every group is really worried about those 3 days at the homestay and then come back like Selena, right? It's the best part, right?
Yeah, it's definitely worth it.
And we feel once they've pushed the envelope that far, the next time they have an opportunity to stay with somebody in their home, they'll manage it, you know.
So it's the Bali Art Project, and this coming weekend is the annual art show. It's Sunday, the 28th of April. From 11 to 5, and if you want directions, you can call 988-7209, or you can email baliartproject@earthlink.net. Galen Duke and Xenia Victor are founders and leaders of the Bali Art Project. Selena Baca went on it last year. Thank you all for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you.
And I'd like now to welcome Amy Christian. She's Artistic Director of Wise Fool, and Alessandra Ogren, who is Director of Seesaw, which is their new performance, which is happening very soon, starting Friday the 3rd of May and going through that weekend. Welcome, ladies, to the Radio Cafe.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
So Wise Fool is a group that's been around for a long time, and it's... What would you call yourselves? It's not exactly a circus.
Circus is one of the mediums that we work in, but we think of ourselves more as a social justice theater company, and we focus in physical theater, circus, and puppetry.
And so what is Seesaw about?
Seesaw is about migration and immigration, and came out of a lot of discussions about feeling that as artists living here in New Mexico and artists anywhere in this country, that actually addressing what's happening about immigration in this country is a really critical issue, and that it felt irresponsible that we as artists weren't having any response to what's going on. And so we decided to really take that on as the theme for the new show that we were making.
Now, does it have a verbal component to it where you're talking about stuff, or is it more like the physical?
It's a physical, I would say it's, in a lot of ways, it's a dance piece. It's a stilt piece, a stilt and aerial dance piece on a moving kinetic sculpture. And so it really addresses the issue of migration and immigration from the standpoint of movement.
So if somebody who didn't know it was about immigration saw it, how would they, what are the clues?
That's a good question.
That is a good question.
I think that we're really looking at it from sort of like the human experience perspective, in the bigger picture of migration as something that has always happened and will always happen with animals and humans, and looking at how sort of we as people react to our space, how we claim home, how we react when we're forced away from home, how we recreate home where we are, those kinds of experiences. And so as you're watching it, it's more of a heart and soul experience, mm-hmm. of those feelings, as opposed to like, here's a story and this is how we feel about it, or this is what we think. It's more about evoking a sensibility around that and then having people come into discussion from that. So from the experience of watching it, questions arise or thoughts are provoked, that dialogue can happen between people watching and the artists. And so the more spoken component kind of comes in later.
Mm-hmm. Do you build that in? Do you have like Q&A or discussion or whatever after performances?
Yeah, that's something that we hope to have happen formally and informally after the performances. And also when we were creating the piece, we were really, we designed this sculpture that the piece takes place on, with really looking at like the cause and effect of humanity and how one thing that one person does has a direct impact on something that someone else does. And looking at the issue of migration and immigration as really looking at what's causing it, and that we kept coming back to those issues in our research and development for this piece is, why are people, for example, in New Mexico, why are people choosing to migrate here from other countries, and what's the cause of that, and what's the effect? And I feel like people often are looking at just the effect, and they just see, oh, people are crossing the border, and they aren't looking at the causes of that. Why are they doing that? What's the, you know, and if you trace that back to, you know, policies and a lot of those things that originate in policies from the United States are what's forcing people, right, to migrate here and then be criminalized for doing that. And so we felt like the central character in many ways of this piece is the seesaw that we designed and built with that thematic in mind, and looking at that character of cause and effect and how we as humans are at the mercy of each other and having to kind of balance and deal with this larger mechanics of society.
Is there an actual seesaw in it that you guys are using? Is that the big sculpture?
Yeah, the sculpture, actually, it was created by some kinetic sculpture artists up in Taos, Christina and Christian. And they made this amazing structure that has like a 20-foot long truss atop a tower. So not only does it seesaw, but it actually rotates 360 degrees. So it spins and seesaws at the same time. It's quite an interesting journey to make art on it.
Yeah, I was going to say a little scary.
But it really comes back to what Alessandra was saying about what the piece is about, which is that the whole time we're making the piece, we're constantly having to negotiate. If I move a foot further in towards the truss, the weight is heavier on the other side, that person drops to the ground, are they ready for it? There's a constant awareness of each person balancing out the other person, and every move we make causes an effect on the other side of the seesaw. And so the experience of making the piece is actually a microcosm of the macrocosm of every policy we make in this country then affects other countries and other economies, and then people are forced to move because of that, and then we complain that they're moving. And
right,
there's just
exactly.
like this whole, and that happens everywhere. It's not just this country. It's happening all over. And climate change plays a role in it as well. All the choices that we're making about our lifestyle are assisting climate change to get
exactly.
you know, more dramatic changes, and so that's then causing people to have to move because of that. And so really looking at how we're all playing a role in this.
I think it's the kind of the big paradigm shift of our time, which is that everybody is connected to everybody else, and it's not like you can do something here and it stays in that isolated area.
Absolutely.
So this is a visual and acrobatic representation in a way of of a lot of those ideas. Very interesting. So you're seesawing, you're hanging from things. I can't even, I haven't seen a rehearsal yet, so I'm sort of imagining you guys swinging around in the air.
We also start on stilts, and all of the, there's five performers in the show, and we come from all different places to arrive at this site, and each person kind of carries their own sort of home, which is a sculptural piece made by Chinupa Hanska Lugar, who's an artist in the area, and we all arrive together to this world, meeting each other, seeing the structure, sort of the societal mechanism that we have to fit ourselves into, and seeking how and in what ways we have to adapt or we can adapt the space to us, and really kind of going through that whole journey.
So it's called Seesaw. It's Wise Fool's new project, and it premieres on Friday the 3rd of May at 8 in the evening, and it's Friday at 8 o'clock and then Saturday at 1 and 8 o'clock in the Santa Fe Rail Yard Park. So it's outdoors.
Mm-hmm. It's outdoors and it's free to the public.
Yay.
Yay. And actually at the Saturday show, at the 1 o'clock Saturday show, we're collaborating with the Rail Yard Park stewards, and they're going to be doing a tree planting after the show as part of the whole experience, which is partly in conjunction with Arbor Day, but also looking in terms of its relationship to the show, just kind of looking at where we set down roots and how we create longevity in a space. And so we're really excited to be collaborating with the Rail Yard Stewards also.
Do you travel shows like this?
We are definitely going to be traveling the show, and we made it actually very specifically, which I realized also around the themes of migration, that we created this show so it could easily migrate, and that the pieces, all of the sculpture breaks down into pieces that we can carry with us. And that was actually an important part, even though it was very challenging, of creating the whole show, is that it would be able to travel. And the first place we're going is to Taos on May 16th.
Nice.
And we'll be doing a benefit performance for the show to actually go to. We were invited to perform at a few different street theater festivals in Colombia, in Bogota, in August. So the May 16th will be a benefit event with bands and music, and we'll be performing the show up there in Taos.
And so, moving the whole device down to Bogota?
Yes.
Yeah.
Amazing.
It all fits in cases that can go on an airplane, believe it or not. It's kind of incredible.
Very well
And then
done.
We have festivals all over the country that are already talking to us about the next festival season. So we have a show, Flexion, that's been touring for the last 6 years, and we've toured that to, I think, 14 festivals all over the U.S., and this will be kind of our next offering to those festivals, all of whom have been like, when is your next show coming out? So we're pretty sure that this is going to get around the U.S. and definitely Colombia and hopefully some other countries as well.
It's called Seesaw by Wise Fool. And once again, Friday and Saturday, May 3rd and 4th at the Santa Fe Rail Yard Park. Amy Christian is Artistic Director of Wise Fooled. Alessandra Ogren is Director of Seesaw. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
And Wise Fool is on the web at wisefoolnewmexico.org.